Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, February 23rd, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to have a spoiler-filled conversation about Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook's new movie, Drive Away Dolls. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editors BJ Colangelo.
Hi.
And Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
All right, guys. I just thought it would be cool for us to talk about this movie. I saw it last night. I think both of you have seen it. You saw it a little while back. So hopefully it's still relatively fresh on your minds. Let's kick things off with just like general thoughts. BJ, let's start with you. What did you think about this movie?
Oh, man, I'm so sorry. This movie's going to become my entire personality for the next like 3 months. Yeah, this is another movie like Lisa Frankenstein that just like hits very specific beats that make me very happy. I loved seeing it. I loved seeing Trisha Cook finally get to have a movie on the big screen because I'm a big fan of her short films as well as her work as an editor on Coen Brothers movies. But I've been really missing a movie like this that just really leans in to being kind of dumber than dog shit in like a positive way.
Brad, what'd you think about this one?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with this one. This is like, it's a great caper, like the kind you'd expect from if we had both of the Coen brothers, but even with one half and working with, you know, Trisha Cook, it still has the, you know, a little bit of their signature style to it. And it just feels like it has some like nostalgic energy to it without being like necessarily specifically nostalgic for like any one movie or thing. It just feels kind of like a genre that we don't get much of anymore, that we used to see a lot more of. And I just had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, I appreciated the sort of like simplicity of the story. Like, you know, these characters basically like stumble across something that they shouldn't have. And the whole movie is about sort of a slow chase almost to a climax. And I sort of appreciate the simplicity, the streamlined nature of that. I didn't like this movie as much as either of you did. I laughed a handful of times, so I appreciated the comedy aspect of it. I kind of felt like it had an odd mixture of tones. I felt like it whipped back and forth between being really goofy and really sincere. And there are times when it's basically like a live action Looney Tunes cartoon. And then there are times when it feels more like a genuine relationship drama. And I just thought the mixture of and transitions between those two things didn't quite gel as smoothly for me as I'd have liked. But I'm wondering what you guys made of the, I guess, those shifts in tones. BJ, start with you if you have anything to say about that.
To me, I love when movies do things like this because that feels very reminiscent of my own life. Like, you know, you can have a day where something is really tough and you have to have very, very serious conversations, and then later on get like high as hell and watch Jellystone cartoons and laugh until you're crying. And like, that's kind of how this movie feels, where there are those moments that feel so ridiculously and cartoonish, but then there are parts that feel so serious because that's kind of what life is. Like, life is so unserious while also being the most serious thing anything any of us will ever experience.
Brad, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, like, to me, I feel like it's something kind of like the Coens have done before. Like, they have tinges of absurdity in their movies, and then they have moments of sincerity and like seriousness and like, you know, even like, you know, incredible violence, and they just managed to mix them all together very nicely. And I feel like Drive Away Dolls did that pretty well. I didn't have a problem like mixing the two because I liked the authenticity of the relationship between Geraldine Viswanathan and Margaret Qualley, but then I still loved the silliness of like the chase and like the bumbling guys chasing them and all of that stuff. So like, yeah, I didn't have a problem with those two things coming together at all.
Okay, so you mentioned the actors there. Let's talk about them one by one and just their performances and the vibe that they brought to this movie. Let's start with Margaret Qualley. That accent is quite a lot. As somebody from the South, I feel kind of attacked every time I hear any actor try to do a Southern accent on screen because it's almost never right. Like, I'm thinking of Keanu Reeves in the what's the one where he Al Pacino plays the devil?
Star Wars.
Yes, of course. The Devil's Advocate is the movie I was thinking of. Where Keanu Reeves is just like trying and failing and just sounds nothing like
that's
anybody.
That's not fair though, because like you pick Keanu Reeves doing any accent and that's the complaint you're going to get. Because like, I mean, Keanu Reeves, come on. The guy's great. Accents are not his strong suit. So. Okay.
All right. Fair enough. I'm just thinking about that one specifically because he's from Gainesville in that movie and I like went to college in Gainesville and I know people from that area. I've spent a lot of time there and nobody ever sounds like that there. But anyway, I kind of felt like this accent that she's doing is like a mix between Nicolas Cage and Holly Hunter in Raising Arizona. It was like a weird sweet spot between the middle of them. I eventually sort of like came to begrudgingly accept it, but I will admit that it was a bit of a hurdle for me at the start of this. What do you guys make of the accent? And then we'll just talk about like the rest of her performance.
I'm so glad that you brought up the Raising Arizona thing, because this is exactly who this character feels like. Is like, the character of Jamie feels like she was plucked out of like Raising Arizona, and she's doing such a Nicolas Cage thing. And I'm very curious, like, to see how other people are going to feel about her character, because I kind of locked in on it immediately of like, oh, this is a Cage thing. But also, we have a tendency to not accept that women know what they're doing when they're intentionally making these choices like we do. Like, oh, that's just Nicolas Cage doing his thing. Everyone just accepts it. When women do it, they're like, that was a bad choice. I didn't like them doing that. And it's like, why? Why do you think that they're not capable of making this consciously? But the accent, it's like so difficult to place where it is coming from. She claims Texas. No one that I know from Texas sounds like that. But at the same time, I don't care. Like, I love the Bear, and they often say the word mom instead of mom, and it's like, that's, I don't care. Who cares? It's goofy. I have fun. I don't care.
I have like, just, you know, being from the South, I have like a particular hang up about this sometimes. I don't mean to take it out specifically on Margaret Qualley. My issues go far beyond her performance in this movie to Hollywood.
This episode into like Ben's dialect therapy hour. Like, I have no problem.
Yeah, for me, it's more about like the personality that comes through, even if the accent isn't accurate. Like, it just adds a dimension to her character that that just helps the character shine.
Her saying things like honey bun, I'm in. Like, you sound like you might work at a truck stop diner somewhere off of like Route 66. I'm down.
I kind of like, I like that stuff. And then there were moments where she would do it almost in like back-to-back sentences, and I'm like, all right, that's a little much. Like, even for a character where that's supposed to be your personality, I kind of feel like there were moments where the script had her like pressing down the gas pedal a little too hard. But I don't know, that's somebody, or that's just like that's a personal preference thing, I think. And that was just, I sort of bumped on that a little bit, as the movie was going on, but I generally loved like the sort of, I don't know, she almost had like a swinging dick energy or something about her, where she just kind of like didn't care and is very much her own person, is super confident and like walks into any situation knowing that she's going to be able to sort of take control and do whatever she needs to do. So I appreciated that and didn't really have any qualms with the character beyond that, really.
We call them Lestharios in the community.
Okay. I've never heard that term. That's amazing.
You're welcome for your gay education of the day.
Okay, so Geraldine Viswanathan, I thought she was terrific. She, I mean, obviously she's like a little bit more of a buttoned up character than Margaret Qualley. She's not doing an outsized accent or anything like that. So maybe that's part of the reason why I, if not related more to her character, than like appreciated more of what she was doing here. But what did you guys think about her? BJ, let's start with you.
So I love the character of Marion. I'm not quite a Jamie, but I'm definitely more Jamie coded than I am Marion coded. So I have an affinity for Marion characters because I often am the person who takes these baby birds under my wing. And it's like, all right, let's get you out there and break you out of your shell. And for the love of God, stop wearing such high necklines. So I love her character. And I think she actually has the harder job in this movie, because playing the person that's a little bit more buttoned up, that's a little more insecure, that's a little bit smaller, is way harder to make, like, do effectively when you're surrounded by such larger than life characters. And I think she nails it. Like, she is such like the grounding rod of this movie.
Yeah, I definitely, man, I can't wait. I hope that Hollywood is watching and like just puts her in more stuff. I mean, she broke out, I think it's fair to say, with her role in Blockers, but that was like several years ago. That was like 2018, 2019 or something like that. And she's been in a handful of things since.
Have either of you seen The Package?
No, I haven't. No. What's that?
Oh, my dear gentle Jesus. Okay, so The Package is one of those, like, randomly shot, like, just dropped on Netflix comedies. And it's her and then the actor who plays the pizza boy in Stranger Things, who's in a ton of things, and I can never actually remember his name.
Oh, yeah.
But he's the lead in it. But it's about, like a bunch of friends going out and having, like a camping trip, and then they accidentally cut his dick off. And then the entire movie is about them trying to get his dick to the hospital so they can reattach it. And she is so ungodly hilarious in this movie. And that was when I was like, I don't know who this girl is, but she is a superstar. And then I started finding her in other things. I actually got to interview her for Rumble, that animated monster wrestling movie with Terry Crews. She's a delight too. So like that also helps.
Fantastic. Okay. Brad, what did you think about her in this movie?
Yeah, I think she's fantastic. Honestly, I think I've developed a little bit of a crush on her based on her performance in Blockers and now this. And now I need to see The Package because I also just saw that that's directed by Jake Szymanski, which, you know, he's a great comedy dude. So I'm gonna have to seek out The Package. But yeah, she's great in it. And like, you know, I knew that she could be, you know, have like the role of like the outgoing, you know, more boisterous character, because that's kind of what she does in Blockers. So having her be more reserved here, she's a great counter to Margaret Qualley, and just the two of them together make for such a great pair in this movie. So yeah, I hope people start casting her in more things too, because I think she's great.
Mm-hmm. So one question that I wanted to pose to you specifically, BJ, is like, do you think this movie is a throwback to something? Because my wife and I were watching it last night, and after we were talking about it, and we kind of landed on the idea that this movie kind of feels like it's referencing things that we haven't seen. And I, like, the extent of my personal exploration of queer cinema in the late 90s was Kevin Smith's Chasing Amy. Like, that's about as far as I got, you know, my knowledge of
some good stuff.
I know my knowledge of that period. I've heard you talk about But I'm a Cheerleader and movies like that before. And I just, my knowledge of that period and that entire, like, I don't know what you would want to call it, milieu of filmmaking, that subgenre, that whole community of filmmaking is extremely, extremely limited. So I was wondering if this movie is a throwback to something that I just didn't recognize. And I know that you're much more familiar with that whole corner of the cinema landscape. So what do you think about that?
Sure. So this, to me, the answer is yes and no, because yes, it absolutely is a throwback to the new queer cinema movement, where you started getting Jamie Babbitt and Gregor Rocky and all of these like very specifically like weirdo queer movies. But the thing is, they've been trying to make this movie since that time period. But a lot of those movies that were made in that, like in the 90s, were very, very, very low budget. And this is a movie that requires a little bit more of a budget because it is a road trip movie, and that is going to require more money. And people just were not ready to have that. So there are moments in the script where I can still feel like, oh yeah, this was written in 1998. Like, I can feel that. So it definitely is a throwback to that filmmaking period, but also it comes from that period. It just took forever to get made, which I find very, very interesting. It feels like a movie from that era, but with money, which I like. But then something else is that this has become such a throwback, though, because it's so much a love letter to lesbian bar culture. And unfortunately, as of, you know, this recording, there are less than 30 lesbian bars in the entire country. There's a wonderful docuseries called The Lesbian Bar Project. I highly recommend people check it out. But this is paying homage to a time period that was thriving when they started writing the script, but that doesn't exist anymore. So there were like a couple of moments in this where I was like getting a little verklempt, because I'm like, oh yeah, that's not a thing anymore. That's just not a thing we get to have anymore. And that sucks. But I love how joyous this movie is embracing it. So yeah, it's weird. This is a movie that feels trapped within two different time periods, where yes, it's a throwback, but also it feels like it was made in the 90s and then plucked and dropped in 2023.
Mm-hmm. Brad, did you have that same feeling when you were watching it? Like, maybe this is referencing something that I don't know what it's referencing, or was that just me?
Partially, but I didn't realize that the movie had actually been in development for so long, that it was written back in the late 90s. But like, you do like feel the vibe of a movie that was made like in 97 or 98. It just has that feeling to it that adds to the throwback vibe. For me, I kind of felt like that there was a 1970s sexploitation vibe that was also under there too, especially when it comes to the psychedelic interstitials, which like don't really make a lot of sense until you get to the end of the movie. And so that was something to me where like it felt like they were infusing, you know, that like that 90s style movie with a little bit of like old school sexploitation from the 70s as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah, totally like Russ Meyer era, which
yeah,
Trisha Cook has talked about, like she intentionally wanted this movie to be a little sleazy, and who else to emulate than Russ Meyer?
Okay, so actually you just touched on something that I want to bring up in just a second. Let's take a break and then we'll be right back. Okay, so those psychedelic transitions that you mentioned, I felt like they came out of nowhere because I think objectively they did. But Brad, did the end of the movie sort of make those make sense to you in a way? Because I walked away from that being like, why were those there? What is going on?
Yeah, so I do feel like the earlier ones, they almost feel like just like a strange stylistic choice. And then once like you start to be able to discern the fact that that Miley Cyrus is in them, and then you see what that's leading to, like it makes sense in the grand scheme of like the story that's being told. But like part of me wishes that there was a little more smoother way of introducing that concept, because like otherwise it just feels kind of like a non sequitur, like almost like it's from the viewpoint of like the case of dicks in a way. Like this is the story of how the dicks came to be.
Yeah.
But it was a nice touch, and it was interesting to me, but it did feel, at least for the first half of the movie, that it was kind of separated from everything else that was happening.
Yeah, what did you make of those moments, BJ?
So when we first started getting kind of like the lava lamp vision of psychedelic, you know, scene transitions, I had this moment of like, okay, clearly this is here for a reason. This is going to lead to something. What is it going to lead to? And then as we started getting more and more insight into what Miley Cyrus's character of Tiffany Plastercaster is doing, it like I then enjoyed all of those moments. I'm like, oh, I like that you teased this to me this way, because this reveal really works for me, because I am absolutely obsessed with the real life Cynthia Plastercaster. So to see a character, you know, homaged in this way, I thought was really clever. And I thought Miley Cyrus is a perfect bit of metacasting, because she's got a foundation called the Happy Hippie Foundation. So she's a hippie. Also, that foundation works to like help unhoused LGBTQ youth. And this is a gay movie. I was like, oh, you all like really nailed it with this casting here. This is great.
Yeah. See, I didn't even know that Cynthia Plastercaster was a real person. Like, I'm so disconnected from like the real life, whatever this is based on.
Ben
that
Pearson,
I have no
are you
idea
telling me
real.
You've never heard the song Plastercaster by Kiss? What is happening?
No, I can't say that I have, actually.
Yeah, she's a real person. Her cast of Jimi Hendrix's penis is in the Icelandic Museum of like phalluses. She's a legend. She died last year, or in 2022, RIP. She's great. I have an article about her coming out soon.
Oh man, I can't wait to read that, because yeah, that's once again a whole area of the world that I have no idea what I'm talking about there. Okay, so did the cameos work for you guys? It sounds like the Miley thing definitely worked for BJ. Did that work for you, Brad? And then we'll talk about the other big name that shows up in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like Miley Cyrus is the kind of person who like I would prefer if we got to see her popping up in like more random, strange roles like this. You know, she kind of just has a cool a vibe about her, and so it was like just a surprising moment, and it worked for that kind of character. You know, she kind of just fit in with that style of having this like hippie girl. And then Pedro Pascal was a fun addition. Like to me, the cameos in this movie, including Matt Damon, they're the kind of cameos that I appreciate so much more than just like throwing a big star in as a surprise, because these cameos, they weren't treated as surprises. Like the trailer didn't try to hide them at all. Both Pedro Pascal and Matt Damon are in the trailer. And I even think that you see Miley Cyrus in the trailer, actually. Mm-hmm. So like there wasn't even really a surprise there. It's just cool having big names in very small roles like this. And like, especially seeing Matt Damon in this role, you know, as the senator who, you know, had his dick, you know, like cast and turned into a dildo without his permission. It was just a funny little touch. So like I really liked the cameos.
Yeah, I had no idea that Matt Damon was like heavily featured in the trailer. I think because I saw, maybe I didn't even watch the full trailer. I was just like, I saw enough of it to be like, yes, I'm interested in this movie. And then maybe I bailed from there. But so I was surprised when he showed up. To me, like the appearance of Matt Damon specifically, it kind of reminded me of his appearance in another movie, which I'm sorry to spoil for anybody who hasn't seen it yet, but it's a couple years old at this point, and there's no way to really talk about this without just coming right on saying it. But it reminded me a little of his appearance in Steven Soderbergh's No Sudden Move, where he has like a similarly small role as this shady figure who's been kind of like pulling the strings the whole time. And Soderbergh is not exactly the same type of director as Ethan Coen, and he makes all kinds of different projects. But watching this did make me wonder if Soderbergh is kind of becoming like the heir apparent to the Coens in a way, especially with his crime dramas. And I was wondering if either of you had any thoughts about that.
No, I think that you're definitely onto something in terms of Soderbergh kind of following in the Coens' footsteps. Like the Matt Damon character, like I knew he was there, but in the trailer he's only presented in the scene where he's holding the briefcase and he's got the hat on and he's clearly trying to be incognito. So the reveal that he's a Republican senator and there's that like horrifying billboard of his horrifying blonde family was so funny to me. And so I loved him being here. I loved his, you know, surprise. I also love when actors are willing to lean into the fact of like, yeah, this is what I look like, and that's totally fine, even though I doubt this is not Matt Damon the man. Like, that's not how he is as a person. But yeah, he looks like someone who could be on Fox News and they'd love him. Why not? Mm-hmm. So I love that. And the Pedro cameo, like, killed me. Like, it was so funny. His head in a hat box is so funny. But the fact that he gets his eyes thumbed again, like Game of Thrones, I was howling in the theater.
Yeah, that was very funny. Brad, do you have any, I guess, additional thoughts about Matt Damon or the Soderbergh connection at all?
No, not really. I think you're kind of right on there. Soderbergh definitely has tendencies of the Coens just in his own way.
Okay, so BJ, I have here in our notes, who is Trisha Cook? And I know that you wrote this whole article that it's called, If You're a Coen Brothers Fan, You Also Love Trisha Cook, Even If You Don't Know It. And I just wanted to clear out and give you some space to sort of explain. I mean, we've alluded to her role in this movie a little bit, or role behind the scenes, rather. But I was just wondering if you could tell me a little bit about who she is and why she matters to you.
Sure. So Trisha Cook, most people that are writing about her are writing her as like Ethan Coen's wife and sometimes editor of Coen Brothers movies, which, yes, is true. But Trisha Cook has been an editor for a very long period of time. Trisha Cook is also a lesbian. And if that doesn't make sense in your head of like, well, how is she married to a man then? They're poly. They have other partners. They've talked about it. This isn't news. This is no different than like a gay person marrying their friend and raising children together because, you know, they're friends and they love each other. But like, no, Trisha Cook's a lesbian. So Trisha Cook is, you know, the longtime editor of the Coen brothers. She first joined up with them on Miller's Crossing. She's also, you know, one of the editors of like The Big Lebowski and like a lot of their comedies. She's very integral in the editing process, and comedy films live and die by their editing. And so a lot of the things that I think people view as like, oh, these are Coen touches, like they're also just as much her hand and her creative vision as well. And like, I think that's a very important thing that, you know, often gets looked over. But she is the one who came up with this title. It was originally supposed to be Driveaway Dykes, but that changed for obvious reasons. But she, you know, was the one who came up with the idea. She wrote on this. She's also co-directed some very, very queer specific short films that are really hard to find because that's just unfortunately the nature of a lot of queer media. So something else that I think is very interesting is I was lucky to witness a Q&A with The Advocate and Ethan and Trisha after my screening of this. And Ethan is very bold in saying like Trisha Cook co-directed this. The only reason she doesn't have the director like label like officially is because she's not a member of the DGA. And also the two of them don't care. Like straight up, they're like, we don't care. They're like, we don't care if people don't understand our relationship. We don't care if people don't understand that she also co-directed this despite not actually getting a directorial credit. Mm-hmm. And so I think to me, that is even more exciting because there are so many things in this movie that like, no shade to Ethan Coen, he's brilliant, but like, a dude could not have come up with this. Like, this is so clearly like lesbian filmmaking and somebody who is really, really versed in lesbian culture and lesbian filmmaking, which Trisha Cook is. Mm-hmm. And so this movie does not exist without her hand. And I wrote that piece because it has been very frustrating how many people are just like, ah, it's the solo Coen movie. And it's like, this is co-directed too. This, it just is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's different. I think maybe it's tempting for people to refer to it that way because Joel Coen, Ethan's brother, directed The Tragedy of Macbeth not too long ago. And that was like, Joel Coen, by the way, was like the one who, I think I have this right, he was traditionally credited as the sole director on a lot of the Coen brothers projects, even though he co-directed them with Ethan. And it's, again, because of like DGA rules and things like that. I'm pretty sure that's correct.
Yeah.
Maybe just because he made The Tragedy of Macbeth, and that was like a solo directorial effort. He didn't have I mean, his wife is Frances McDormand, who's starred or co-starred along mm-hmm. with Denzel Washington in that movie. So he didn't have like a creative partner in the same way. Maybe Trisha Cook is just getting like minimized in this conversation, this discourse around this movie. But obviously it's important to include her in this conversation. Okay, before we wrap things up here, I just wanted to know, like, where would you guys rank this as, I guess, in the Coen filmography, even though, you know, this is a technically like a separate thing than a quote unquote Coen brothers project. Do you have like a shifting Coen brothers ranking or anything, or any idea of where this might fall for you, either one of you?
So the Coen brothers movies are all pretty much so great. Like there's a few duds in there for sure that like I'm not necessarily a fan of, but like they have so many great movies, it's kind of hard to like crack some of those top tier ones. And they also have such like a vast like array of like variety among what they do. You know, we're talking going from Fargo to Big Lebowski to No Country for Old Men to A Serious Man, Burn After Reading. You know, like they share certain traits, but like they go back and forth so seamlessly between doing this like bleak drama, you know, crime thriller kind of stuff to doing absurd dark comedies. And they're all so good in their own ways. So like, for me, I think that this movie is probably more mid-tier just because it's hard to hit, you know, some of those movies from the Coens that I love so much, but I still really dug this movie. So like having it, you know, be a mid-tier Coen brothers movie is by no means like a slight against it.
Mm-hmm. BJ, what about you?
This is, you know, on like personal feelings, this one's really high up for obvious reasons. But I will say, and this is, again, not to shade any of the films that came after, because I do love all of them quite a bit, but this is my favorite Coen Bros movie since No Country for Old Men, which was 2007. Mm-hmm. And like, that's not to say I don't love A Serious Man or Hail Caesar or True Grit or any of those, because I do. But this is like a movie that made me so excited. Like, I left the theater and all I wanted to do was talk about it with other people. And I haven't had that feeling about one of their films in quite some time. And so that was a big thing for me. But also, you know, this is a movie that I hate the idea of like quote unquote important cinema, because I think that, you know, that's subjective and that can change no matter who, you know, who's the viewer. But this is a piece of important cinema because lesbian movies, especially made by studios, don't get to just be silly and they don't get to be just fun. They're always really dramatic or traumatic, and like, no shade to Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I love you. You're beautiful. But like, this is what I want out of lesbian cinema. Mm. And so to get it is very exciting, because if this succeeds, then it proves like we can have more stories where people just happen to be lesbians and their stories are fun and goofy. It doesn't have to be about being a lesbian.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, we should say, like, if you've not seen this movie, but you're listening to this conversation, like, there's so much lesbian sex in this movie. It is like out of control in like a great way. Like, it's so, you know, it's more than I've ever seen in a mainstream American movie anyway. So like, there's definitely something to be said for that. And like, it's kind of just amazing that like a studio released something like this, just because for like the sheer fact that you don't see this very often. But as you point out, rightly, BJ, like, of course, this should be much more commonplace than it actually
is.
Yeah,
it's, so. Oh my God, like Beanie Feldstein unscrewing a wall-mounted dildo was one of the, like, I laughed so hard, and there were a couple people in my screening that were like, is that a thing, or did they just do that to be funny? And I was like, why do you think they sell them with suction cups? It's so they stick to the wall. Like, come on. And they're like, I had no idea. They're like, I had no idea. And I was like, well, now you do.
Yeah, for me, I feel like, first of all, there are a handful of Coen Brothers movies that I still haven't seen. Like, I missed A Serious Man, which I know people love, and I still need to see Barton Fink and The Hudsucker Proxy. But for me, I would put this one somewhere near the middle, probably like you, Brad, like maybe sandwiched somewhere between like Ballad of Buster Scruggs and Burn After Reading or something like that. But yeah, I guess like we're pretty close to the end here. Do either one of you have any closing thoughts on Driveway Dolls or anything that you wanted to highlight that we didn't mention in this conversation at all?
I mean, I don't think we didn't talk about Bill Camp in this movie, but he's hilarious. So just shout out to Bill Camp for being super funny in this movie.
Yeah, Bill Camp is, he's so funny and really makes the best of his small role, which I love. And just Coleman Domingo is always the best casting decision anyone can ever make. He's also so funny. I don't know, if anyone's throwing a basement makeup party, please send your invitations to me. Thank you.
I'm gonna go to a basement makeout party.
Okay, well, I think that's going to do it for today's show. You can find more about Driveway Dolls and all the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com. I will link to, we have like an Ending Explained article. We have BJ's piece about Trisha Cook. I'm going to link to all that. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe to our newsletter. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a ton. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all on Monday.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.